Good evening, and thank you for joining the E*TRADE Financial third quarter 2012 earnings conference call. Joining the call today are Frank Petrilli, Chairman and Interim Chief Executive Officer, Matt Audette, Chief Financial Officer, and other members of E*TRADE's management team. Today's call may include forward-looking statements which reflect management's current estimates or beliefs and are subject to risks and uncertainties that may cause actual results to differ materially. During the call, the company may also discuss non-GAAP financial measures. For a reconciliation of such non-GAAP measures to the comparable GAAP figures, and for discussion of additional risks and uncertainties that may affect the future results of E*TRADE Financial, please refer to our earnings release, furnished with Form 8K and our 10Ks, 10Qs, and other documents that company has filed with the SEC. All of these documents are available at investor.etrade.com. This call will present information as of October 18th, 2012. The company disclaims any duty to update forward-looking statements made during the call. This call is being recorded, and replay will be available via phone and webcast later this evening at investor.etrade.com. No other recordings or copies of this call are authorized or may be relied upon. With that, I will now turn the call over to Mr. Frank Petrilli. Please go ahead, sir.
Good evening. Good evening. And thank you for joining today's call. I've now served in the role of interim CEO for a little over 2 months and have spent nearly 9 months as chairman of the board. During this time, I've come to learn and appreciate a great deal about this firm and its management, and my confidence has never been higher that executing on the strategic plan outlined earlier this year is the right path toward creating shareholder value. Despite our disappointing bottom-line results, we have made meaningful progress on our plan and put in place several key building blocks to drive future execution of our strategy. Matt will take you through the financial results and many of the specifics you may be interested in, but I would first like to walk you through what I consider to be the most important areas of focus and our progress against them. When I assumed the role of interim CEO in August, I committed to the board that I would place unwavering focus on four key elements of our strategy, which fit neatly within the company's overall strategic and capital plan that we presented to our regulators in June. My key areas of focus are as follows. First, expand the brokerage business. Now, this has been at the heart of everything the company has been doing for quite some time, but it is especially important today as we cannot lose focus of our overarching purpose marked by our goals to expand market share and to increase penetration of our existing customers' assets. Second, strengthen the financial position of the company. This speaks to both the balance sheet and the income statement and will always be a focus, but is particularly important today given the meaningful value that can be unlocked through the execution of our strategic plan. Third, focus on cost reductions and efficiencies. This obviously ties in directly with the second area I just discussed, but it is a heightened area of focus not only while I am at the helm, but also going forward. And fourth, build out our enterprise risk management framework to be appropriate for our size and complexity, mindful of the current regulatory environment. I will now take you through our progress on each of these areas of focus. With respect to expanding the brokerage business, despite less than favorable market conditions this quarter, we were still able to bring in net new brokerage assets of $1.9 billion. DARTs of 129,000 in the third quarter were down 22% versus the year-ago quarter, reflective of both disengagement on the part of the retail investor and a normalization versus the year-ago period when volatility was at a multi-year high surrounding the U.S. debt downgrade. In October, customer trading has continued to decline. As of this afternoon, in fact, DARTs are down 13% from September and 7% from third quarter levels. While trade volumes exhibited the seasonal slowness the industry has come to expect from the third quarter, the mix of our trades actually saw improvement over the period, as options trades represented more than 25% of total DARTs. This continues to be an important area of growth for us, not only because options trades have a higher associated level of commission than cash equities, but they typically set the stage for additional transactions due to their fixed expiration dates. And what customers appreciate most about options is the ability to generate income or protect positions in any kind of market. Also relating to trading, our principal transaction revenue was up this quarter in the face of a decline in customer trading, as our market-making operations saw an increase in order flow from external parties and some benefit from disruptions amongst peers during the quarter. Net new brokerage accounts of 18,000 bring our year-to-date total to 110,000, already above the 99,000 that we acquired during the full year of 2011. Very importantly, we are also keeping more of our brokerage accounts, as evidenced by vastly improved account retention over the past few years. This quarter marks our second best ever with respect to brokerage account attrition. Our annualized rate of 8.5% is up just slightly from the firm record 8.4% we saw in the second quarter and 200 basis points better than our levels a year ago. This is such a critically important statistic for us, since it encapsulates all that we are doing to drive customer satisfaction for the future profitable growth of our franchise. Growing our retirement and investing offering is core to our strategy of expanding the brokerage business, not only because it builds upon a less volatile source of annuitized revenue, but it importantly serves as a pathway to deepen engagement with existing customers, thereby driving quality asset growth. We currently estimate we hold 12% of our customers' investable assets on average. We view this as a meaningful opportunity to leverage our most valuable asset, which is our current customer base, for future growth. While we have long offered a suite of retirement and investing products and services, we have been enhancing it and turning our marketing attention toward repositioning the brand as a trusted destination for retirement assets, managed investment solutions, and advice. Part and parcel is our focus on our team of financial consultants, which we've grown by about 40% in just under 2 years, currently standing at over 270 professionals. These financial consultants were responsible for approximately one-third of our net new assets during the quarter and are bringing on accounts which are 6 times greater in size than our traditional channels bring us. This represents an average account size of approximately $140,000, more than double the $60,000 in average account size across all brokerage accounts. Additionally, financial consultants have been crucial to growing our managed assets, which have now crossed the $1 billion mark after less than 3 years since the products were introduced. We are building momentum for sustained growth in this arena. Within this key strategic pillar of growing the brokerage business is our goal of enhancing the retail trading offering. To that end, we continued to launch new products and services this quarter and received some valued recognition related to our existing offerings and service levels. Our recently launched One-Stop Rollover simplifies the process for individuals to move their 401k savings into a professionally managed portfolio at E-Trade. With an account minimum of just $25,000, we are offering professionally managed solutions to a population of underserved individuals. Validated by our proprietary surveys, this product fills an important need in the marketplace, as well as in the retirement accounts of our existing and prospective customers. Our mobile offering continues to be an important part of our strategy, and we recently launched our 6th E-Trade mobile application designed for Windows Phone. Mobile adoption rates among our customer base continue to grow, as 6.7% of our trades were executed via these devices during the third quarter, up from 4.8% a year ago. Product enhancements, new offerings, and the commitment to customer service reflect our mission to deliver the best investing experience, period. This mission resonates throughout our company, and as a testament to our employees' hard work, we were recently awarded the number one ranking in Kiplinger's annual Best of the Online Brokers survey. We were also the only firm to receive 5-star ratings in both the customer service and investment choices categories. In addition, our corporate services group received external validation of its success. For the third consecutive year, our Equity Edge platforms were top-rated in overall satisfaction, reporting, and technology by Group 5's annual stock plan administration study, which gauges the overall satisfaction of stock plan sponsors in the United States. Moving on to our next area of strategic focus, strengthening the financial position of the company. For the third quarter, we posted a disappointing loss of 10 cents per share on revenue of $490 million. The quarter's results contained some notable charges, including $50 million in increased provision related to new data on borrower bankruptcies, and $13 million of severance for our prior CEO. Matt will take you through these items in more detail. Within this key area of focus, our main objectives are to improve our capital ratios, with a goal of deploying bank capital to the parent to pay off high-cost debt and to continue to improve the level and quality of our earnings as our legacy costs reduce over time. This quarter, we made headway in terms of both our deleveraging efforts, which we view to be the best path forward for improving our capital ratios, as well as our dialogue with the regulators. Matt will share the details, but at the highest level, we have identified over $4 billion of deleveraging, including $1.3 billion completed during the third quarter, and over $3 billion, which we have targeted for the fourth quarter. As for our de-risking efforts, we continue to reduce the balance sheet risk with a shrinking legacy loan portfolio. The average age of these loans is now in excess of 6.5 years, and the loan portfolio continues to become less of an overhang for this company each day. Our third area of focus relates to cost reductions and efficiencies. Last quarter, our leadership team communicated a target of cutting $50 million from our run rate expenses by the end of 2013, with the goal of implementing the majority within 12 months. We spent this quarter working diligently to identify additional reductions, and more importantly, to drive efficiencies in how we do business. I'm proud to report that the team has built upon their initial target and arrived at $70 million of reductions already identified, with a new target of $100 million in reductions from run rate expenses by the end of 2013. Beyond setting and hitting our targets, and central to this exercise, is the philosophical change to continually drive process improvement through efficiency gains at every level of our organization. I feel good about our progress here, not only as the environment demands this type of introspective review, but because it is the right thing to do for our business and for our shareholders. I have personally spoken to many groups of employees about the importance of this ongoing focus, and I am delighted with their professionalism and commitment to deliver. My last key area of focus relates to the build-out of our enterprise risk management framework to create a structure that is appropriate for our size and complexity. While managing risk has always been a central focus, we are dedicating additional resources and time and energy to formalizing and expanding this function. Given the enhanced regulatory environment and the updated guidelines under our new regulators, the time is appropriate for us to accelerate our focus in this area. While risk management is the responsibility of every employee at E-Trade, it really starts with the appropriate tone at the top, which I believe we have set through internal communications and focused actions. We are enhancing our risk management structure to focus on specific areas, for example, operational risk management, capital planning, and regulatory relations. We are bolstering areas like vendor management and stress testing to highlight a few of the many areas impacted by this focus. As we mentioned previously, we expect this ongoing investment to total approximately $10 million, which includes systems upgrades and headcount, as we hire additional risk management staff, compliance personnel, and auditors. With that, I'll hand the call over to Matt to walk you through the financial results.
Thank you, Frank. For the third quarter, we reported a net loss of $29 million, or 10 cents per share. This included two unique items. First, provision included $50 million related to new data on borrower bankruptcies acquired by the company. And second, compensation included $13 million related to the departure of our former CEO. Taken together, these two items reduced our third quarter results by 13 cents per share. Our third quarter net revenues were $490 million, inclusive of deleveraging-related securities gains. With these gains, revenues were up from $452 million in the second quarter and down from $507 million in the third quarter of 2011. Revenues included net interest income of $261 million, a sequential decline of $18 million, driven by a 16 basis point decline in net interest spread on a relatively flat average balance sheet. Net interest spread fell to 228 basis points for the quarter. The predominant factors which negatively impacted spread this quarter were loan paydowns, continued pressure on reinvestment rates driven by the overall low-rate environment, and an increase in cash, as loan paydowns and securities proceeds were not fully reinvested in anticipation of deleveraging actions in Q4. We now expect our spread for the full year 2012 will average slightly below 240 basis points. All else equal, we continue to expect another 10 basis points of compression in 2013 from 2012 full-year levels. Commissions, fees and service charges, principal transactions, and other revenue in the third quarter were $153 million, down 1% from the second quarter and down 15% from the same quarter of 2011. Average commission per trade was $11.24, up from $10.68 last quarter, as a result of favorable product mix. Year over year, average commission per trade was up from $10.76. Revenue this quarter also included $79 million of net gains on loans and securities, inclusive of deleveraging-related gains, as we sold securities to match a reduction in certain wholesale funding obligations. Our legacy loan portfolio ended the quarter at $11.1 billion, a contraction of $616 million during the quarter. It is now down 66% from its size at the peak. We now expect that loan runoff will average approximately $500 million per quarter for the next several quarters. Provision for loan losses for the quarter was $141 million, up from $67 million in the prior quarter. This quarter's provision included $50 million related to charge-offs associated with newly identified bankruptcy filings. We utilized third-party servicers to obtain bankruptcy data specific to our loan portfolio. And during the third quarter, we identified an increase in bankruptcies reported by one specific servicer. In researching this increase, we discovered that the servicer had not been reporting all prior bankruptcy data on a timely basis. As a result of this servicer shortfall, we implemented an enhanced procedure around all servicer reporting to corroborate the bankruptcy reporting with independent third-party data. Through this additional process, approximately $90 million of loans were identified, in which the servicers failed to report the bankruptcy filing to us. Our longstanding policy is to write down loans to their collateral value when notified that a borrower is in the process of bankruptcy. Therefore, these loans were written down during the third quarter, which resulted in an increase to the provision for loan losses of $50 million. Approximately 90% of the loans written down as a result of this exercise are performing current loans. We also noted these additional charge-offs were not as a result of the recently issued regulatory guidance on the treatment of discharged bankruptcies. Excluding the effect of the additional charge-offs, provision increased $24 million from the prior quarter to $91 million. The sequential increase was due primarily to a decline of $16 million in put-back settlements with third-party mortgage originators. Total net charge-offs in the quarter were $158 million. Excluding charge-offs related to the review of servicer data on bankruptcies, net charge-offs would have been $109 million, down from the $121 million in the prior quarter. Delinquency performance across the portfolio trended positively, as the 30 to 89-day delinquent category improved 6% sequentially and 29% from a year ago. Total at-risk delinquencies, or the 30 to 179-day delinquent category, improved 7% in the period and 29% from a year ago. The total allowance for loan losses ended the quarter at $508 million, a sequential decline of $17 million. The $508 million reserve consists of $191 million for modified loans and $276 million for non-modified loans. In addition, we maintain a qualitative reserve to account for factors not directly contemplated in our loss model. This reserve stood at $41 million, or 15% of the general reserve as of quarter end. Our coverage remains relatively constant for non-modified loans, with this quarter's allowance covering 72% of 90-plus days past due loans. This compares to 67% last quarter. For modified loans, we have increased our total expected losses to 37% from 36% last quarter and increased our allowance accordingly. Our allowance of $191 million for modified loans plus prior write-downs continues to cover the total expected losses in this portfolio. We modified $54 million of loans during the quarter, down from $94 million last quarter. We continue to expect quarterly modification volumes to trend downward as the population of delinquent loans continues to decline. Turning to progress with our regulators on our capital plan, one of our top goals is to distribute capital from the bank to the parent in order to pay off high-cost debt. A gating factor to accomplishing this goal is our banking regulator's comfort with our most constraining capital ratio, Tier 1 leverage. Accordingly, we are focused on improving this ratio through organic capital generation and by reducing the size of our balance sheet. With this goal in mind, we developed a comprehensive strategic and capital plan, which was submitted to our banking regulators in late June. The plan outlined assumptions for capital levels and distributions under various operating conditions and included a holistic forecast of our business and results over the next 5 years. Included in this capital plan and forecast is our assumption that we will be in a place to start distributing bank capital to the parent by the end of 2013. During the third quarter, we received initial feedback from the OCC and the Federal Reserve on the plan, and we maintain an active and ongoing dialogue to ensure our execution of the plan is consistent with their expectations. Based on their feedback, we are confident that the key elements of our strategic plan, specifically de-risking, deleveraging, and the build-out of our enterprise risk management function, are critical. And assuming the successful execution of these key elements, we are confident that our targets for bank capital levels and corresponding distributions of capital will be achievable over time. Our plan includes a target ratio for bank Tier 1 leverage of 9.5%, intended to align with the ratios of other large banks, which currently have leverage ratios within the 9 to 10% range. This threshold far exceeds the current well-capitalized minimum of 5%, and we believe it's within reach given our current leverage ratio of 7.9%. We plan to achieve this target ratio by generating capital through earnings and by deleveraging the balance sheet. We expect this target leverage ratio to decline over time as we improve our credit and risk profile, earning stability, and build out a top-tier enterprise risk management program. We plan to reduce the current target threshold of 9.5% by 50 basis points each year beginning in 2014, ultimately settling at 8%. And most importantly, our plan includes quarterly distributions from the bank to the parent of capital in excess of our target thresholds beginning by the end of 2013. While we believe our capital plan is achievable, it is important to note that any capital distributions would be subject to the approval of our banking regulators at the time of the request and could be influenced by factors not currently contemplated in our plan. In addition, I would highlight that while Tier 1 leverage is currently our most constraining ratio, all required capital measures, including Tier 1 common and risk-based, would be taken into account by the regulators when considering requests for capital distributions. We tend not to highlight these ratios as they are currently well in excess of regulatory minimums and consistent with other dividend-paying institutions. Nevertheless, these ratios would also improve along with Tier 1 leverage supported by ongoing earnings, deleveraging, and the runoff of higher risk-weighted legacy assets. As a matter of course, we continue an active dialogue with our regulators on this plan and our assumptions and are increasingly confident that our strategic and capital plan is the best path forward to unlocking shareholder value. Now, while an optimal capital structure would have us eliminate holding company debt through a distribution of bank capital to pay down the notes, the timing and size of any such distributions would be subject to the schedule, targets, and successful execution of several elements of our strategic plan. While we work toward that goal by focusing on improving our bank's leverage ratio, we are duly focused on refinancing high-cost debt down to current market rates. Focusing on the $930 million of 12.5% notes due 2017, we estimate that a refinance today could reduce the coupon by more than half. Factor in the total costs associated with that debt, including the original issue discount and the unfavorable tax treatment, and we estimate that a refinance at 6% would benefit earnings by approximately 20 cents per share annually. Consequently, our focus continues to be addressing this debt once it's callable in December. There is also an opportunity to further reduce our debt costs by refinancing the $243 million of 7 7/8 notes due in 2015. If we were to refinance this full issuance alongside the 12.5% notes at the same illustrative rate of 6%, we estimate the benefit to earnings would be an additional 1 cent of annual EPS. Beyond improving earnings, refinancing either or both of these notes, in whole or in part, would also reduce the use of corporate cash while lengthening our maturity profile. That said, one of our key objectives with any new debt issuance would be to create a structure that allows for prepayment within a reasonable period of time without costly penalties in anticipation of ultimately receiving bank capital distributions. As I highlighted last quarter, refinancing the 12.5% notes would result in a loss, which would negatively impact our parent Tier 1 leverage ratio by approximately 50 basis points. Given our goal to maintain a buffer above the fully phased-in, well-capitalized minimum of 5%, our deleveraging efforts are integral to strengthening this measure in order to complete a refinance. The strategic and capital plan that we submitted to the OCC and Fed in June includes the assumption that we refinance the 12.5% notes in the next few months, bearing in mind they are first callable in December. As an assessment of the parent debt falls within the purview of the Fed, we maintain an active dialogue with them around our plans to complete a refinance. Turning to our financial position, corporate cash ended the quarter at $431 million, representing over 2.5 years of debt service coverage. Refinancing expensive debt would obviously improve this coverage ratio. Our risk-based capital ratios at both the bank and parent increased during the quarter, while the leverage ratios remained relatively flat, driven by the third quarter's net loss and balance sheet growth. While we did complete some deleveraging actions during the quarter, our liability-driven balance sheet hinges on customer cash levels. This quarter, customer cash and deposits grew by $3.2 billion, principally generated by $2.2 billion of customer net selling activity and strong customer asset inflows during the quarter. Nonetheless, our Tier 1 leverage ratio at the parent increased 10 basis points to 5.8% and remained flat at the bank at 7.9%. Our parent Tier 1 common ratio ended the quarter at 10.9%, and we estimate it would have increased by approximately 100 basis points under the proposed Basel III guidelines. Reducing the size of our balance sheet remains a top commitment for us as we view this to be, along with earnings generation, the most effective path toward improving our capital ratios and ultimately distributing capital from the bank to the parent. We currently have several initiatives completed or underway, which total over $4 billion. In addition, we have identified other opportunities which are not yet underway. The actions completed during the third quarter are as follows. First, we terminated $520 million of our fixed-rate wholesale borrowings, which were set to expire in 2014. This resulted in a $51 million charge on early extinguishment of debt and was offset by security gains, as assets were reduced to match the reduction of liabilities. Second, we moved $470 million of sweep deposits off balance sheet as a result of eliminating one of E-Trade's three bank charters. We utilized five charters which act as a waterfall for customer sweep deposits. Previously, the first three were E-Trade's, with the fourth and fifth belonging to third-party institutions. This quarter, we completed a liquidation of the third charter, and the balances were assumed by an outside institution. The associated liabilities of $470 million were swept to that third-party institution, and subject to regulatory approval, we plan to dividend approximately $50 million in capital associated with this charter to the parent in the fourth quarter. Third, we changed the default cash option on our account application to a third-party money fund as opposed to on-balance sheet cash products. This is beneficial to us from a leverage perspective and to the customer from a yield perspective. We have since added $300 million in customer cash to this fund. Fourth, we recently reduced the rate paid on the majority of cash products to 1 basis point. As for the initiatives which are underway or have been completed since quarter end, first, just this week, we completed the transfer of $1.2 billion of sweep deposits from our second charter to a third-party institution. With this transaction, our 5-charter sweep product now has E-Trade in the first position, with the other 4 charters all off-balance sheet. Second, we plan to terminate or reduce wholesale borrowings by an additional $900 million in the fourth quarter. And lastly, we are pursuing a conversion of $1 billion of customer payables into third-party money market funds. In addition to deleveraging, transferring these balances would also have the benefit of reducing our lowest yielding asset, segregated cash. In addition to the initiatives I just covered, reducing banking cash continues to be a key focus, as it is not core to our strategy or balance sheet. Year to date, we have reduced banking deposits by $600 million. We continue to pursue alternatives to reduce these balances further, though we don't have anything to announce today. Including the initiatives already completed and those in which we have a high degree of confidence, this equates to over $4 billion of deleveraging actions. We recognize that this quarter's efforts were offset by growth in customer cash. However, customer net selling was the primary driver of this growth, and we expect that to fluctuate over time. As a reminder, our customers were net buyers of $3.9 billion in securities in the second quarter of this year. To that end, I would note that customer net buying in October has already reached approximately $700 million, with a corresponding reduction to customer cash and thus to our balance sheet. With $1.3 billion of deleveraging initiatives completed in Q3 and over $3 billion targeted for the fourth quarter, we are making progress toward our goal of $5 to $10 billion in balance sheet reduction. With that, I will turn the call back to Frank for closing remarks.
Thank you, Matt. In closing, while I'm not pleased to report a net loss, I'm very proud of the team and our accomplishments, particularly how our team executed this quarter against our long-term strategic plan. We believe there is significant value embedded in this franchise, and we are focused on unlocking it for shareholders. Deleveraging is an integral step in getting us closer to both our long-term goal of eliminating debt and our intermediate goal of refinancing it. As you have now heard, we made significant steps forward in terms of our deleveraging efforts. Management is fully committed to executing against cost-cutting initiatives and ushering in a philosophical change around efficiency gains and process improvement. We continue to grow our core franchise, even in the face of challenging market conditions characterized by declines in retail engagement and heightened macroeconomic uncertainty. Finally, with respect to the search for our permanent CEO, the board is actively engaged in this process. We've hired a top-notch search firm, Spencer Stuart, and we are encouraged and impressed by the quality of candidates we've seen thus far. We will obviously update you once there is something to share. As we wrap up the year, our commitment is that we will maintain laser focus on continuing to execute on each pillar of our strategy. Areas such as deleveraging, refinancing high-cost debt, and expense reductions will remain top of mind for the management team. Additionally, we look forward to continuing the dialogue with our regulators related to our capital plan. With that, operator, we are ready to take questions.
Absolutely. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephones. You will hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. And if your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw the registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. And if you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handsets before entering your request. One moment, please, for our first question. As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, press the 1 followed by the 4 to register any questions. And we have our first question from the line of Alex Blostein. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks. Hey, good afternoon, guys. All right, so a couple of things. So number one, on the incremental $3 billion of deposits that you guys are planning to move in the fourth quarter, Can you give us a sense of how much in earnings that will cost you now in the spreads that you guys can move them at? And then more importantly, I want to kind of draw a parallel from that to your desire to refi the debt at the end of the year. I think last quarter you talked about kind of maintaining a 5.5% Tier 1 leverage at the Holdco. I mean, it feels like your core earnings is about 3 cents this quarter. So you're growing a little bit slower. You're moving some deposits off. That's going to pressure organic capital generation. And to refi the debt, you're going to get a 50 basis point capital hit. So kind of help us understand, I guess, what is your willingness and ability to refi in December, seeing how you're naturally just generating less capital organically?
Sure, Alex. This is Matt. So, yep, understood. So with respect to the $3 billion of deposits in Q4, if you look at our Q3 results, hopefully you notice the increase in cash on the balance sheet. So not customer cash, but E-Trade cash on the asset side. So we held off investing in loans and securities in anticipation of the deleveraging. So that's one of the things that really drove spread down in the quarter. So if you take where we are today, the impact on earnings of the deleveraging in Q4 really isn't that meaningful given it's in cash earning, you know, fairly low rates, especially the segregated cash, which is single-digit basis points. So not a huge item. With respect to refinancing the debt, I think the 5.5% target you referenced last quarter is the right number. And I would say we feel confident that with the $3 billion of deleveraging and our focus on refinancing in Q4, we feel confident that $3 billion is the right number to facilitate that refinance.
Okay, and did you guys get any feedback from the Fed on whether or not you'll be able to refi and, you know, go lower in your Tier 1 leverage at least temporarily, and they'll be okay with that?
So we're in active dialogue with them. So I think that's the most that I can say. We feel confident that $3 billion is the right number. We are in active dialogue with them on this transaction, and our strategic plan assumes that we'll do so in the next few months. So that's the most I can say.
Got it. And my second question was on the incremental provision this quarter. I guess you guys provided a little bit of color on, I guess, what caused you to investigate the issue to begin with. But I think more importantly, looking out at the business and the practices that you have in place, do you need to dedicate more resources to make sure that something like this, I guess, either A, doesn't happen again, and again, more importantly, how did the regulators feel about this event? I don't know if you guys had any communication with them since.
Yeah, no. So we are in active dialogue with our regulators on everything of importance. So absolutely on this one as well. I think that the key thing is that this came up fairly recently, just over this past weekend. And the key thing for us, hopefully if you followed in the prepared remarks, is one particular servicer reported to us an increase in bankruptcies. And our own analytics and our own procedures noted the increase, and we looked into it further. So I think we feel good that our existing process caught this, and I think we feel even better that we've added a second process to go out and get some independent data to check the entire portfolio. And the thing that probably the best thing that I would add to that is when we came back, ultimately concluding with the $50 million in write-down, the majority of it was from that one particular servicer, meaning there was not a systemic problem. So I think with everything I've just said, I think we feel good about this issue going forward.
Got it. And just the last one on this topic. So the $90 million that you identified, what's the breakdown between home equities and first liens? And then was the home equity written down to zero?
So the majority is home equity, and we wrote it down to collateral value. And the collateral value for home equities, especially those in a second position, is pretty close to zero. So it's a fair assumption it was written down to zero.
Great. Thanks so much for taking my questions.
Yeah.
And our next question comes from the line of Joel Jeffrey. Please go ahead, Mr. Jeffrey.
Good evening, guys.
Hey, how are you?
Just a question. In terms of this specific servicer, I mean, historically, had their bankruptcy notifications been significantly less than the other servicers you've used?
No, it was the exact thing that occurred is our analytics of the reporting noted a spike. So it really jumped out. There wasn't anything abnormal in the past.
Okay, and exactly how many servicers do you guys use?
I don't know, in the less, you know, roughly 50, less than 50 range.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking my question.
Our next question is from the line of Keith Murray. Please go ahead, Mr. Murray.
Hi, guys. can you just give a little color on the $900 million of wholesale reduction that you outlined for fourth quarter? What would be the hit against that?
Sure. So we're specifically we're targeting fixed rate Federal Home Loan Bank advances. So similar to what we did, the $500 million that we did in the third quarter, which had a $51 million prepayment penalty associated with it. So I don't have the exact number of what the prepayment cost would be, but you would likely see a similar dynamic in Q4 in that we would sell securities to facilitate the reduction of those wholesale borrowings. So no precise numbers, but the same type of transaction.
Gotcha. And then in your discussions with the regulator, I know the special servicer that you found, you know, this one issue with. Has that come up, and do you have any concern that this is something that maybe should have been caught and they will kind of look negatively on that?
Well, anytime we note an issue, we always would feel like or hope we would have caught it before. But I will tell you, we fully briefed the regulators on this particular issue, and I would just reiterate that we are, you know, we're pleased that our own process and our own analytics noted the issue. We looked into it further. And then implemented an additional process above and beyond to go out to a third party to validate our entire portfolio. So while you know we're not pleased that we have this $50 million charge, we're pleased how we identified it and how we reacted to it.
Thanks. And then a last one. Actually, you know what? I apologize. That's it. Have a good night. Thanks.
All right.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from the line of Rich Repetto. Please go ahead, sir.
Yeah, good evening, guys. I guess my first question is, Matt, you alluded to this weekend. This came to light this weekend. Can you expound on that, what the process was here this, on identifying this?
Yeah, sure, Rich. So our analytics noted this an increase in bankruptcies in this particular servicer in the last month reporting. So it really came up recently. And based on those analytics, we decided to go add this additional procedure. So it was something that came up fairly late in the process. So we worked throughout the weekend to make sure that we were comfortable with the data we had, and it ultimately led to the identification of the $90 million and the $50 million write-down that we've discussed. So there's really no more to it than that. Is there anything particular you were that I missed there?
No, I was just wanted to make sure that when you said this weekend, I was just trying to clarify the timing because, you know, we were all looking at this thing, you know, last week with J.P. Morgan and their reporting. But anyway, next question.
Yeah, it was a different issue. It was not connected to what the change that they had.
Understood. And then, Matt, on the NIM, you know, we just did rough calculations. And I understand that that you have uninvested cash or cash sitting on the balance sheet, uninvested. But you're actually, I guess, with your guidance of a NIM just under 240, and then 10 basis points down from there, you're expecting a NIM rebound. Given even in this current environment, you're expecting the NIM to rebound, given your actions, I guess.
Yes, and specifically related to the cash that we have on balance sheet ahead of deleveraging. So if you look at that cash, between segregated cash, it earned 7 basis points, and our regular cash, it earned 21 basis points during the quarter. So when we deleverage through that, you're really improving the spread in Q4, everything else being equal. The other thing I would highlight for the 10 basis points, incremental basis points down in 2013, the same way during 2012, we've ratcheted down during the year. We'd also ratchet down during 2013. So we would likely enter 2014 probably down 15 basis points versus 2012, if that helps.
Understood. Thanks. And the last thing for Frank, Mr. Efficiency here, leaving his mark on the company, I guess, the $70 million in cost saves, you know, up from the initial 50 and you're targeting 100. Can you give us a little bit more, what do you call it, specificity on where these coming from? You know, is it headcount? Again, sort of same questions that we asked last time, but you've had another quarter to look at this, and I know this was in your past has been, you know, your area of focus. So, you know, where is E-Trade, how's E-Trade going to come up with the $70 million?
So, Rich, thank you for not ignoring me, but I'm going to pass it to Matt, the numbers guy.
All right, Rich. So now I would speak to our target of 100. So we've identified 70, but we're focused on getting to 100. And I would start off first. We've assumed in that 100 about 20 million is for marketing. And then for the rest of the 80 million, I think the best way to think about it is just looking at our expense base overall. There are certain things from a cost reduction program perspective that you really can't impact, things like FDIC expenses, clearing and servicing, depreciation and amortization. Those are the things you can't really impact. What we can impact is comp and ben, professional services, and contractors and the like. So really costs really connected to people. So, you know, people that aren't necessarily employees of the company, but all the people costs in our financials. So that's where we'd be focused.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Take care.
And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, press the 1 followed by the 4 to register any questions. Our next question is from the line of Chris Harris. Please go ahead, Mr. Harris.
Thanks. Hey, guys. So the 9.5% Tier 1 leverage target for the end of 13 for the bank, I wonder if you guys can help us out a little bit with how you plan to get there. How much do you think is going to be driven by the deleveraging? How much from potential earnings and utilization of the DTA? Just kind of maybe you can break that down for us. Be helpful.
Yeah. So those are the buckets. I don't have precision on all those items, but I think deleveraging is key. That's where we have the $5 to $10 billion target of deleveraging actions that we're focused on. And then the other bucket is earnings and earnings that utilize the DTA. So those are really the two primary buckets that we're focused on to get there.
So the $5 to $10 billion that you're talking about with the deleveraging, is that really just assuming today's deposit level? So I guess what I'm wondering is if your cash continues to grow as you guys incrementally add more assets, could that number potentially go much higher? Because I mean, this past year you have $20 billion or so of asset growth, given net new assets and market gains, and it just seems like you'll ultimately have to delever a lot more, assuming some of that net new assets isn't cash.
Yeah. So customer flows is really the X factor when you look at a projection for our balance sheet. So the way I think about it is that if we have customer cash inflows that increase the size of the balance sheet, from a deleveraging initiative perspective, we would need to focus closer to the 10. Because the net balance sheet increase would be, or net balance sheet decrease would be a little bit less than that. If customer cash doesn't grow and flows out, then we would focus from a deleveraging action perspective closer to the 5. So I don't have a customer cash forecast for you, but that's kind of the dynamic that would be at play that would move us along in that range.
Okay, and then just last question for me, just following up on the net interest spread here. I was under the assumption that the deleveraging would potentially have a positive impact on the spread, given you're kind of rolling off lower yielding assets, and it seems like it's in line with your prior net interest spread guidance. So wondering what changed with the mechanics. Why wouldn't we see a slight improvement in the spread guidance versus where we were before, given the deleveraging?
Yeah. So the interest before, meaning last quarter. The interest rate environment continues to be difficult, right? Each time we say on a call the interest rate environment's difficult, the next call gets even worse. And QE3 didn't help much towards the end of this quarter. So I think the environment is pressuring spread. Deleveraging, the incremental spread we earn to grow the balance sheet is absolutely low. So to your point, agreed, as we delever, the spread that's coming off isn't incredibly high. But I think the environment is a big driver, and the environment's just incredibly difficult.
Okay. Thanks, guys.
Our next question is from the line of Chris Allen. Please go ahead, Mr. Allen.
Evening, guys. Looking forward to next quarter, and you guys point to kind of the high cash balances on the balance sheet, and that's kind of going to be the bucket you guys look at. I'm just wondering, like, looking historically, it is high right now relative to where it's been historically, but, like, what's kind of the minimum level of cash balances we should kind of expect there, i.e., what else you would need to do above that to drive the debt pay down?
Well, we've got corporate cash just north of $400 million, right? So that's not something that's been fluctuating too much. Within the bank itself, we always want to keep a certain amount of cash for liquidity purposes, you know, call it in the $750 million to $1 billion range. And then you've got segregated cash in the broker-dealers, which is difficult to predict, right? It's a function of our margin balances as well as cash in the broker. So that one's going to be a little bit of an X factor. But that's how I would think of cash in those three buckets.
Got it. Okay. And then obviously you guys are going to have to affect some gains moving forward to offset some of the capital hits. I mean, within the securities bucket, are there lower-yielding assets, say, in the 100 to 125 BIP range that you'll be able to harvest those gains from?
Well, I think the other side of the interest rate environment comment is as we build our portfolio, and the securities portfolio is really the only place where we buy securities and sell securities. Almost everything else in the balance sheet is either a function of customers or a loan portfolio that's paying down. Given those interest rate movements, the vast majority of things are going to be at a gain, right? So just any selling, you're typically going to have gain on sale. And we've seen that for quite some time. So I would expect to see that at a minimum next quarter, and then depending on where the environment goes after that, the environment will tell. But next quarter, I would certainly expect it.
I guess another way of asking it is, putting the environment aside, if the stuff that you're looking at harvesting, would that negatively or positively impact kind of the securities yield as we kind of see it this quarter?
Oh, sure. I would say the environment where we're reinvesting is the primary driver. But the economics of selling a security at a gain means it's yielding something higher than where you could reinvest today. So it would certainly have an impact. But I think the overall environment's probably, and the changes in the interest rate environment are going to be the primary driver.
Got it. Okay. And then following up on Rich's question on the expense saves, should we be thinking about the expense saves above whatever we're building in terms of lower FDIC and clearance and services fees as the portfolio comes down?
Yes. So the $100 million are specific actions we're taking or plan to take. It's not things like the FDIC rates come down or the servicing cost of the portfolio come down. It's in addition to that.
Great. Thanks, guys. I'll get back in the queue.
Our next question is from the line of Brian Vidal. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi. Good evening, folks. Can you talk a little bit about the reinvestment yields, Matt, that you are assuming in your guidance for NIM in 2013? Like, what type of securities would you be investing in terms of a duration profile, and also, you know, what kind of yields are you expecting in that guidance?
Right. So our reinvestment rates have certainly been impacted by the environment. So last quarter, we talked about reinvestment rates in the 125 to 150 basis point range. Where we are in the environment today, it's closer to 100. So you certainly see some compression there. As far as where we invest, there's no change to the investment strategy. It's agency-backed or government-backed securities, mortgage-backed securities. So the same strategy that we've had for quite some time.
Okay. And is the 100 basis points also your assumption in the 2013 guidance for NIM?
So the comment on spread is, given the environment that we're in today, what would happen to the balance sheet going forward. So it's not a comment on where the interest rate environment would be in 2013.
Okay, that's perfect. Okay, and then just again on the cost save side of it, do you have any revenue implications from that? Are you budgeting any revenue implications, or is this a purely a cost reduction that doesn't really have any revenue associated with it?
So we are planning for revenue impact of this, but I think keep in mind the philosophy we have in this. We are focused on cutting lower returning initiatives, making sure we prioritize all the things that are important and are key to our strategic plan. So ultimately, the things that we stop doing or the marketing dollars that we stop spending on the margin would not be impactful from a revenue perspective. But we're certainly planning for some level of impact.
Okay. Can you frame that level of impact at all, or is it too early to tell?
How about relatively minor?
Relatively minor. Okay. And the ramp on that on the cost save program, is it back end loaded towards the end of 2013, or do you expect to be getting a lot of those incremental saves over the next couple quarters or so?
So our objective is to have it all in place by the end of 2013, but the majority by mid-2013. So by the time we are in Q3 2013, we would hope to be in a place where the majority of them are in the run rate numbers for that quarter. But we'll keep you updated along the way on how we're doing.
Okay, and the risk management costs that Frank talked about earlier, the $10 million additional, that is over and above this $100 million, is that correct?
Right, so it'd be a net 90.
Net 90, right, okay. And then just lastly, you said, I think, did you say trading in October so far was down 13% versus September?
We did.
You did, okay. Okay, that's all for me. Thank you.
Our next question is from the line of Matt Fisher. Please go ahead, Mr. Fisher.
Hi, thanks. Good evening. Real close, back on the expenses. The $70 million that you've already identified, have any of that been realized yet or already?
A relatively minor amount. With specific to Q3 results, a relatively minor amount's in there.
Okay, and how much of that do you think you can, you know, start to realize in the fourth quarter?
So it's really the same commentary with Brian on the 100, that we want to get the majority of it in place by the time we are, for Q3 2013's numbers, right? So all of it by the end of the year, but the majority into the run rate for Q3 2013.
Okay. And then the $79 million gain on sale, how much of that is related to the decline in the wholesale funding?
So I think the best way to think about gain on sale this quarter is as if that loss on early retirement of debt, which is down at the bottom of the P&L, was reported back up in the gain on sale line. Right. So when you net those two things together, you're in the mid to upper 20s, which is pretty consistent with what you've seen in the recent quarters for us. They just get reported in a different place. So I just look at them together.
Okay. So the full $79 million would be related to wholesale funding?
No, I would just look at the two lines together, meaning the 79 minus the 51 down at the bottom, right? So you're in the 28 range, which is, you know, consistent with what we've seen in recent quarters.
Got it. And then, you know, like Rich touched on it, but the some of the other banks were reporting the provisions. Basically, if a loan is underwater, or negative equity, if the primary loan is negative equity, then the home equity loan needs to be written down to collateral. And you said that wasn't a factor in today's results. Have you done any analysis around that? I guess, A, why wasn't that? I thought that was kind of implemented in the third quarter, so why wasn't that included? And B, if you've done any analysis in terms of how much of your loan portfolio would need to be marked down to collateral if you did adhere to that new regulation.
Yeah. So I think the change in regulatory guidance, I think, was a little bit different than that. So it was specific to a certain scenario of bankruptcies where a borrower files a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. The bankruptcy is discharged, and then the borrower does not reaffirm the debt. And there was regulatory guidance on that came out that said in that scenario, even if the loan's current, you have to charge it off to collateral value. Our policy on charging off bankruptcies is when we get notice of the bankruptcy, we charge it off. We don't have a scenario where we don't charge it off. And it looks clear from all the banks that are reporting this quarter that updated their policies that they did. So I think a long way of saying our policies were much more conservative. That's why that guidance would have impacted us. It was more about that our servicers and this one particular servicer mostly had simply not reported the bankruptcy to us, and that was the core issue.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Sure.
Our next question is a follow-up question from the line of Alex Blostein. Please go ahead, Mr. Blostein.
Thanks. Sorry, guys. Just wanted to follow up on one more. So I'm a little confused around the cash balances question that somebody else asked earlier. So if I look at the balance sheet, $2.8 billion. You know, you're clearly not going to take it down to zero. You're moving $3 billion. Of deposits of balance sheet, and you're saying kind of like, all right, $3 billion is, you know, we have enough in cash, so it's not really earning us anything anyway. So can you help me understand that? So it does seem like you will have to sell some securities, I guess, to move some of that $3 billion out. And under that scenario, obviously there would be some impact on NII. So I'm sure I'm missing something. Would you mind just kind of fleshing those out?
Yeah, no, I don't think you're missing anything. I don't think the deleveraging in Q4 would be 100% funded with the cash. Just if you look versus last quarter, it grew in a meaningful way. So it's probably, I'd call it the majority of it will be funded by that. But we would absolutely or likely have to sell securities to facilitate this. But then the other X factor will be what customer cash activity is in the fourth quarter. If a bunch of cash comes in, cash goes up, that may facilitate the delevering. If the trend we've seen in October continues with the $700 million of net buying, we would have to sell a lot more securities to facilitate the deleveraging. So it just all depends on the dynamics of the balance sheet in Q4.
Got it. And then if you were to kind of stop the clock today, how much in net interest income would go away given how much in securities you would have to sell?
Yes, yeah, so I don't have that level of precision, Alex. I mean, the balance sheet move is pretty dynamic. So I think we'll have to, you know, the things that I walk through are the best info I could give you, and we'll have to, you know, see how we execute in Q4.
Got it. All right. Thanks a lot again.
Yep.
And our last question is from the line of Chris Harris. Please go ahead, Mr. Harris.
Thanks for the follow-up, guys. Real quick on the provision expense, excluding the one-time item, you mentioned that the majority of the sequential increase is related to fewer putbacks, settlements. Should we expect fewer putbacks on a go-forward basis? So, in other words, will your provision expense potentially be higher over the next couple of quarters than what we've seen in the first half of the year?
So I think generally putbacks should be declining. Our total program to date, or life to date of focusing on this, we're just under $400 million of putbacks. You know, given the age of our loans, we've gone through the vast majority of them. So I would say it's more behind us than ahead of us, but it's not. I wouldn't say it would be zero in the future. I think when we talk about provision on a going forward basis, we repeat over and over again that we think the long term trend of provision will decline, especially as the delinquencies decline. But you can always see variability in any given quarter, and I think the last two quarters are a great example of that. If you take out the 50. Take out the $50 million. You saw $67 million last quarter, which I'd say is on the low end, and then you see $91 million on the quarter this quarter. So that's just a good example about how it can be volatile. But over the long term, we still expect it to continue to decline.
Okay, Matt. And then assuming you guys get the spring note refi done prior to the end of the year, will there be some tax benefits to that? And if there are, maybe can you guide us to a pro forma tax rate you expect?
Yeah, so the pro forma tax rate would be tough. I think the estimated loss in the refinance in dollars would be, you know, north of $250 million, which would not be entirely tax deductible. So I don't have a precise number for you other than the total amount wouldn't be tax deductible. As far as an effective tax rate going forward, I think when you get away from being close to break even or just under break even, that creates a little bit of volatility with the rate. Our long-term expected rate right now is in the 45% range because of about a third of the interest in the spring lien notes is not deductible. Once we refinance, especially if we refinance at the prevailing rates today, that interest would be deductible. So I would think about the long-term rate after that, closer to the statutory rates with all the states we're in of around 40% is a good way to think about it.
Okay, helpful, Matt. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
And, Mr. Petrilli, we have no more questions on the telephone lines. I'll now turn the call back to you for your presentation or closing remarks.
All I want to say is thank you all for your time, and we look forward to our next call. Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines. Have a great evening, everyone.